Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
A child doesn't show us everything about greatness. It's not a perfect illustration. But in many ways, a child shows us the kind of character that Jesus is looking for those who will be great in his kingdom. I'm turning the values upside down, Jesus says. You think that the way to be great is to kick and fight and punch and climb all over people and be king of the mountain and look upon all those people that you've stepped on and defeated so that you can say, I'm great. And Jesus says, no, that's not how a child works.
He who is the least of you will be the greatest. When the disciples question Jesus about who will be the greatest, Jesus points to a child and declares that we must be like the little ones. Jesus was turning the parameters upside down. The Lord is not concerned with status or power. Today, Pastor David will teach us the characteristics of a child that Jesus calls us to have. While most people seek to be praised, Jesus says that if we want to be part of his kingdom, we must be the least. Now, here's Pastor David with part one of his message, Witness of a Child.
All right, Luke chapter 9, starting at verse 37. Now it happened on the next day when they had come down from the mountain that a great multitude met him. Suddenly a man from the multitude cried out, saying, Teacher, I implore you, look on my son, for he is my only child. And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth, and it departs from him with great difficulty, bruising him. So I implored your disciples to cast it out, but they could not. Now let's remember the context. Just before this, and this is where we ended in our verse-by-verse study through the Gospel of Luke. Just before this, the disciples, or at least three of them, Peter, James, and John, were with Jesus upon the Mount of Transfiguration. And they saw something that no other human eyes had seen. They saw something with God's majesty, with the radiance of his glory being manifest in Jesus and Moses and Elijah together there with him. They saw something that was mind-blowing in its power, in its presence there among them. So you have this glorious, literally, a mountaintop experience there at the Mount of Transfiguration. You come down, and there's the needy multitude. And then secondly, among the needy multitude is a father with a demon-possessed boy. You know, what a shock to the system. And I know it's a little bit trite, but it really is a fitting illustration of so often how it is in the Christian life. You have a powerful, transcendent, touched by the glory of God experience. You come down to the yuck, to sometimes the demonic of everyday life. And that's just sometimes how it is. You see, you thought that something was wrong when that kind of thing happened. Really, that's how it is. We're not given these beautiful, powerful experiences so that we can stay there on the Mount of Transfiguration forever. No, you got to come down and mix it up with daily people, some of them who need you very desperately. And that's exactly what the disciples experienced. So they had come down from the mountain, now then into the valley, and what happens? There's a multitude that needs them, and among that multitude, there's a father with a demon-possessed boy. And what did he say? I love how he puts it in verse 38. He says, Teacher, I implore you, look upon my son. He knew something about the compassion of Jesus. Jesus, all you have to do is look on him, and I know your heart will be stirred to meet his need. Look at him, Jesus. Just look upon my need, and I know that you will care for my son who is in such desperate situation. Because look at what it says in verse 39. It's described as saying, a spirit seizes him, and suddenly he cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth and departs from him with great difficulty, bruising him. This description fits what we might call today an epileptic seizure. But whatever the case was, whatever medical diagnosis that we might put upon it today, Jesus knew, and the reality of the situation, that this boy's problem was not merely physical. Yes, we know that there is a physiological, a biological thing that goes on in a person's body that makes them vulnerable or liable to such seizures, to such fits, epilepsy, whatever similar sort of thing it might be. We know that there are totally physical and biological things, but there are sometimes also spiritual dimensions to these things. And Jesus had the perception to know that it wasn't just a biological problem that the young boy had. Jesus could have addressed it if it was just a biological problem. But it was more than a biological problem. Ladies and gentlemen, if it was just a biological problem, Jesus would have said to the man, "Oh no, sir, your son doesn't have a demonic spirit. It's just a biological thing. Let me heal him." But in this boy's situation, it was something more. It was something different. There was something beyond merely physiological causes. Now, the father sensed this. Therefore, while Jesus and the other disciples were up there on the Mount of Transfiguration, the remaining 9 disciples were down in the village below, and the man had brought the boy to the 9 disciples and said, "Please do something for my son." And can you imagine what that scene looked like? The disciples said, "Well, we're experiencing this kind of thing. Jesus had already sent us out. We'd had some success with teaching. We had some success in casting demons out," which they had. It's described earlier in Luke chapter 9 that they did have success. "We know this kind of thing. We can do this." And I don't know what they said. You know, I don't know what words they said, what prayers they prayed, what approach they did. It just didn't work. There was something about the demonic spirit that troubled that boy that made that spirit more stubborn than others. This is what I want you to understand. The disciples had had some measure of success delivering people under the bondage of demonic spirits before. But this particular demonic spirit, in a way that I don't know that we can adequately describe, this particular demonic spirit was more stubborn, was more difficult to remove, was more deeply entrenched. He had his hooks in deeper somehow. How can this be the case? Well, the Bible tells us in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, that there are ranks of demonic powers. And the ranking seems to imply that some have more strength, some have more authority, some have more cunning. I can't say we understand it fully, but we just understand that there's some kind of gradation of strength or cunning or ability in demonic spirits. Some are tougher than others. And this was a real problem because the disciples, no doubt full of compassion, maybe with a touch of pride, felt, "We can solve this boy's problem. Bring him to us." Nothing. Nothing worked at all. So what did it do? Well, it drove them back upon Jesus. Verse 41. "Then Jesus answered and said, 'O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here.' And as he was still coming, the demon threw him down and convulsed him. Then Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the child, and gave him back to his father." What did Jesus do first? First, Jesus, is it improper for me to say Jesus vented a little bit? He looked around at the failure of his disciples. He looked around at perhaps the superstitious faith of the people that would have more faith in the Jesus than they would in the disciples. He looked around at just the brokenness in the world, and he says just sort of in this venting way, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and bear with you?" I just picture Jesus venting a little bit when he says that. But after he's vented, what does he do? He says, "Bring that boy to me. I'm going to meet that young man's need." And notice this, it says very powerfully, "Bring your son here," Jesus says. And then in verse 42, it says, "As he was still coming, the demon threw him down and convulsed him." I just want you to picture that scene for a moment. Jesus says, "This faithless and perverse generation, how long do I got to bear with this? Bring your son here." And as the father brings the boy to it, the boy has another one of his episodes, another one of his demonically inspired traumas right there in front of Jesus. I want you to understand, this is an illustration, this is an example of what so often happens in the lives of people who just begin to come to Jesus. They just begin to come to Jesus, and it seems to get worse than ever before. Notice how it's phrased there. It says, "And he was still coming, the demon threw him down and convulsed him." That's what it says in verse 42. It's as if the demon was saying, "This is my last chance. I've got to make this father so afraid. I've got to fill this boy with so much doubt. I've got to intimidate Jesus or somebody. I'm not going to give it up easy. I'm going to go out fighting." And he threw him down to the ground and convulsed him. Think about this. Think about, you know, that praying mother or that praying father who prays for their child who needs Jesus so badly, and their life is so messed up, and they just can't seem to see it, and they're just pleading and praying for that son or that daughter, and they come closer and closer to Jesus, goes, yes, and then some, and then it's like the devil throws them down. Well, listen, this is what you got to do. Don't lose heart. Don't lose heart in the midst of that. You see, the boy was so precious to God and so hated by Satan that he wanted to throw everything he could at that last moment. You know, Charles Spurgeon had a great sermon on this verse. This is what its title was. He titled it, The Devil's Last Throw. And he considered some of the lies that Satan throws at somebody just as they're coming to Jesus. Just as their heart is beginning to be stirred, just as they're starting to come to Jesus, it's as if the devil throws more lies at them ever. And he just listed a few of them. Here's some of the lies. You're not elect. You can't come to Jesus. You're too big of a sinner. You can't come to Jesus. It's too late. You can't come to him. There's no use in trying. Just give up. Or this won't work for you. I just imagine there's somebody probably listening to me right now. If not in person, you're going to hear this later on. You're going to hear it through the miracle of MP3, or you're going to hear it on a podcast. You're going to hear it someplace or another down the road, and you're going to be in that exact situation that I'm speaking of. You've started drawing close to Jesus. You haven't fully surrendered your life to him. You wouldn't say that you're really converted by the Spirit of God, but the closer you get, it seems like the worse things get, and now Satan's shouting at you. He's telling you, no, forget it. You're too far gone. You're too messed up. It won't work for you. Don't you see what he's doing? He's trying to throw you down in a last desperate act before you yield your life to him. Well, don't go for it. What did Jesus do? Verse 42, Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the child. Bam, it's gone. That's all there was to it. If the devil tries to throw you down as you're coming to Jesus, just walk right, then crawl to Jesus. Then roll to Jesus. Then do whatever you got to do. You just get yourself to Jesus, and he will bring the healing and the power that you need. Powerful, amazing. Verse 43. And they were all amazed at the majesty of God. I'm sure they were. They were amazed at the majesty of God from the Mount of Transfiguration. They were amazed at the majesty of God when they saw the authority and the power of Jesus, that even when the devil was trying to make a last-ditch effort to hold on to that young boy, Jesus would have none of it. They were all amazed at the majesty of God, but while everyone marveled at all these things which Jesus did, he said to his disciples, let these words sink down into your ears, for the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men. But they did not understand the saying, and it was hidden from them, so they did not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about this saying. You know, sometimes I think we try to psychoanalyze the disciples too much, but I can't resist it. Okay, here's how I think it worked in their heads. Jesus, earlier in the chapter, speaks to his disciples, and he says, guys, I need you to understand, I'm going to Jerusalem, and they're going to reject me, and I'm going to be betrayed, and I'm going to be given over to the Gentiles, and I'm going to die a shameful death on the cross, but don't worry, I'm going to rise from the dead. Well, this totally blew their minds. They couldn't believe it. No, what are you talking about? We didn't follow you because you're a loser. We followed you because you're a winner. Losers die at the end, not winners. Jesus, this is all wrong. But then two things happened after that. The first thing was the transfiguration. Now, wouldn't that encourage you? Yes, okay, he is the winner. Look at him. Moses, Elijah, Jesus, glory, winner. That's good. Then he comes down off the mountain, mixes with the needy crowds again, and then he delivers this boy who's bound to the demon. Man, that's what a winner does. And I can just imagine the disciples thinking something that some of the psychoanalysts that I can't really, you know, keep myself from this, trying to get inside their heads. The disciples think something like this. I'm glad he got that crucifixion thing out of his system. He had us going there for a minute. But when I saw him, you know, magnified on the Mount of Transfiguration, when I saw him deal with that demon, I knew this man's a winner. He's no loser. Thank heavens he's got that stuff out of his business. And then what does Jesus say? He says, no, let these words sink down into your ears. I am going to the cross. Don't you forget it. This is what God has called me to do. You see, you might only think about it occasionally, but I want you to think about it all the time. I want you to put a focus upon it. I am going to the cross. The Son of Man is about to be betrayed. I'm going to go to the cross, and are you guys going to come with me? We're going to see just in this chapter, Jesus is going to begin his journey towards Jerusalem, and it's almost as if he's speaking to the disciples very plainly, going, this is what's going to happen to me to Jerusalem. Are you in? Are you in with this? You guys want to stay up around Galilee, or do you want to come with me? This is what's waiting for you. He announced it to him plain and simple. Verse 46. Then a dispute arose among them as to which of them would be the greatest. Could we just stop right there? Isn't that great? You know, the disciples, they're interested in the scriptures. They're interested in, you know, theology. They're interested in the truth. And people who do that, they love to talk about theology. They love to talk about this biblical passage and that biblical. They love to talk about this doctrine and that doctrine and how the different doctrines and this rabbi and that rabbi and all these great discussions, all these great debates and things that you love to talk about. What was the disciples' seemingly favorite topic of conversation? Which of them was the greatest? I'm better than you. No, I'm better than you. Isn't this crazy? That this was actually a topic of conversation with them. Which one of them would be the greatest? All right, let me read it again. Then a dispute arose among them as to which would be the greatest. And Jesus, perceiving the thoughts of their heart, took a little child and set him by him and said to them, whoever receives this little child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you all will be the greatest. The disciples were very much concerned with this question as to who would be the greatest. It's something that they thought about and talked about a lot. Maybe they wondered if Jesus had not already chosen one of them to be the greatest. After all, did he not take a privileged three up upon the Mount of Transfiguration? Maybe one of those, Peter, James, and John, maybe one of those would be the greatest. And so they're thinking, okay, well, it's me. And maybe, well, let's let Jesus settle this. Now, by the way, when they were thinking of greatness, they were thinking Jesus is going to Jerusalem. He may very well establish his messianic kingdom. Who are his chief lieutenants going to be? Who's going to be, so to speak, the vice president? Who's going to be the secretary of state? Who's going to be the secretary of defense? Who's going to be all these great cabinet officers, so to speak, if you were to analogize it to our political structure? So what did Jesus do? Verse 47 says that Jesus, perceiving the thought of their heart, took a little child and set him by him. What did Jesus do now? He takes this child. They're having their little argument. No, I'm better. No, I'm better. He takes a little child and he just sticks him right there. You see what he's saying right there? This child should show you something about greatness. Now, right there, I am blown away at the humility of Jesus. If Jesus really wanted to talk to them about greatness, don't you think he could have said something like this? Hey, morons, I'm the greatest. Don't you think he could have just referred to himself? Okay, but he didn't. The humility of Jesus would not allow him to speak so disgracefully of the disciples as I jokingly said morons, but either to make this direct reference to himself. Instead, what did he do? He took a child and put them in the midst, and he said, this child is your model of greatness. He said this, if you guys want to be great, learn something from this little child. Now, please remember, especially in that culture, children were of little importance. They weren't threatening. They weren't concerned with social status, and they weren't jaded by success or ambition. And when we fulfill the same kind of humble place that a child had in that culture, then we're on our way to greatness. Now, I don't want anybody to mistake. A child doesn't show us everything about greatness. It's not a perfect illustration. But in many ways, a child shows us the kind of character that Jesus is looking for those who will be great in his kingdom. I'm turning the values upside down, Jesus says. You think that the way to be great is to kick and fight and punch and climb all over people and be king of the mountain and look upon all those people that you've stepped on and defeated so that you can say, I'm great. And Jesus says, no, that's not how a child works. A child is something different. A child has a different kind of character. Notice this too, just a side point. Jesus did not point to Peter. Now, under some theological systems, people who prize Peter as being, you know, some very, shouldn't have Jesus said, well, Peter, he's the greatest among you. He didn't say that. He took this little child, and what did he say? Did you see it there in verse 48? Whoever receives this little child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him also who sent me. This child is a representation of me. You receive this child, it's like you receive me. And if you receive me, you receive my Father in heaven. That's what Jesus said. Indirectly, Jesus pointed to himself as being the greatest in the kingdom. But most pointedly, he put that child forth as an example. Listen, is there any doubt that when you had the 12 disciples, Jesus, and whoever else was around there, and that child, of those 14, 15, however many people, who was actually the greatest in the kingdom there among them? Wasn't it Jesus himself? But Jesus says, no. What's important about this child that I want you to learn is the way he's like me. Jesus said, I'm not concerned about my own status. I don't have to be the center of attention. Just like a child, I'm unable to deceive. I don't have an intimidating presence. That's how it is with children. Honestly, you're walking along the street, a dark alley, a shadowy figure comes down the other side. If it's an 8-year-old kid, you're not afraid, are you? Children aren't intimidating. Children can't deceive, can they? You ever seen a 7-year-old try to tell a lie? It's actually pretty funny. Again, I'm not trying to say, and neither was Jesus, that children are a perfect representation of the kingdom. But they're a powerful one. Now, since the nature of Jesus in these regards is like a little child, how we treat those who are humble like children shows what we think of the nature of Jesus. That's why Jesus said, whoever receives this child in my name receives me. You despise those children. There's things about those children that actually you also despise about Jesus. Why? He says this here in verse 48. For he who is least among you all will be great. This is fantastic, isn't it? How strange this is. How wonderful that there's a room full of people here tonight who are reading this and actually taking it serious. That Jesus says, okay, here's what I want you to think about if you're going to be a part of my kingdom. Be least. Did anybody put that anywhere on their list of New Year's resolutions? Be least. You see, the desire to be praised and to gain recognition should be foreign to a follower of Jesus. Jesus wants his followers to embrace least as a choice. It's entirely different when least is impressed upon you and you have no choice about it, right? But it's a different thing when you choose to be least and when you're happy with it.
For many of us, studying the Bible is a part of our everyday lives. There seems to always be those sections of Scripture that are difficult to understand. What did Jesus really mean when he said, "And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you"? Was Jesus literally telling us to disfigure our bodies? Of course not. We know that's not true. So what does it mean? This is where God has used men like Pastor David Guzik in the writing of commentaries. Pastor David has written numerous commentaries throughout the Bible. In fact, you can find commentary on the entire New Testament and most of the Old Testament at enduringword.com. These commentaries are available digitally at the website and even in mobile format. concise thoughts about the history, context, and author make these commentaries a valuable resource as you seek to know Jesus more. We encourage you to log on to enduringword.com and select the book and chapter you're currently studying. Or you can purchase a copy of Pastor David's commentary for your Kindle or even a printed copy. Simply log on to enduringword.com and select books from the main menu. Another great option from Pastor David is his book, Standing in Grace. This book details the fact that those who belong to him are not only saved by grace, they stand in grace. Again, for all these wonderful resources and more, log on to enduringword.com. Well, that concludes our time together today. Please place a marker in your Bibles and make plans to join us again for the next edition of Enduring Word Radio.